with Norman Dillman, and this is September 29th, 1977. This is Bob Wernley of the Montgomery County Historical Society, and I'm interviewing Norm Dillman, who has been a longtime resident of Waveland, Indiana. And we're going to talk today about things that happened back when he was younger, living down in Waveland. Now, I'll start out by saying, Norm, that the reason I'm called you in here about this, I've talked to several people about, told me stories about the almost bank robbery they had down in Waveland back in the days in the early Depression, or maybe even before that. I talked with Claude Moore, and another fellow I talked with was Frank Shanks, and they both told me that Norm Dillman knew the details about that time they had that scare down in Waveland. Now, starting with that, why don't you tell me what you know about that?
Well, Bob, it happened on February the 6th, to the best of my knowledge, 1930. And you spoke of the Depression. Very definitely, we was in the bottom of the Depression at that time. And Waveland had been before then a pretty thriving town. We had just lost our railroads, especially the Central Indiana, and times was pretty rough for the little town of Waveland. And then to think that an organized gang could come in and just completely wipe out our bank was something else.
But well, now, wait a minute, Norm, before we start on this, I forgot to ask you, what was your birthday? How old are you?
Well, tomorrow will be my birthday, and sorry to say, I'll be 63 years old. My birthday was September the 30th, 1914.
Mm-hmm. And you were born in Waveland?
Yes.
Okay. Well, now let's go ahead and start. We kind of get an idea how old you were when that robbery took place.
All right. Fortunately for the people of Waveland and the Bank of Waveland, about a year and a half before this occurred, there had been an organization set up throughout Montgomery County, and I think the surrounding counties, some of them, known as the Vigilantes. Mm-hmm. And the three men who were actually on the Vigilantes organization in Waveland was George Slavens, Theron Bonta, and Frank Gardner. George Slavens was the mail carrier. Theron Bonta was the assistant manager and cashier of the Waveland Bank, and Frank Gardner was at that time a barber. Now, was on a Friday night, as I recall, and I can remember that we had gone to a basketball game there in Waveland, and we came home, went to bed at a fairly late hour, as I remember right, probably around midnight.
Now, who was we?
Well, the we would be my sister then, and Martha Massey. Uh-huh. And about 1:30, I think think everyone, practically everyone in town was awakened by a tremendous blast.
Mm-hmm.
I think that my father and I both suspicioned the same thing at the same time due to the fact that there had been some bank robberies in this area before that that had used almost the same technique. They just literally took TNT and blew the safe completely apart.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course there has to be a lot of fear involved in that, but I was young and immediately I thought of one thing, that was going to get my rifle.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my father, he completely thought of something else, and about the time I got the rifle, he sent me to the basement.
Mm-hmm.
So we went through the first and second and third explosion, and by the way, there was 9 distinct explosions. And about the third explosion, the vigilantes had organized and got up and assumed positions behind different buildings and started shooting at the bank robbers. Well,
how'd they see him?
Well, in answer to how they saw him, there were street lights in Waverly, and there, between the hotel and the bank, there was about a 10 or 12 foot opening that went full length of the buildings. In other words, the buildings were not joined together. It happened so that there was a street light west of that, and that cast a light in between these buildings. Well, also these street lights were of course lined up and down the main street of Wayland and Cross Street, making it possible that the fellows could see partially into the bank. From my view, which I had persuaded Dad to let me get back upstairs and look out the window again, minus the rifle.
Well, now, where was your house from? Where did you live?
We lived directly across the street.
Uh-huh.
In the house now occupied by Fred Whitecotton. And it is just about 75 yards directly across the street from the bank. I could see directly into the bank.
Mm-hmm.
I could see the fellows with their flashlights setting off the charges. They would be, it was approximately 10 to 12 minutes between each charge. It took them that long to set the charge and place it in on the safe door. Now, of course, after about the third blast, Mr. Bonner, Mr. Gardner, and Mr. Slavens started shooting, as I remember right.
Now, didn't they have a town marshal down there?
Well, yes, we won't mention the town marshal, but he went to bed.
Oh. Who was the town marshal?
I don't think we ought to say that.
Okay. All right, we'll go ahead. You could see into the bank.
I could see into the bank.
And which direction from the bank was your house? Was it east?
Directly east.
Mm-hmm.
George Slavens was firing a shotgun, and he was behind what was then the O.K. Galloway garage and filling station. And he was within range of this, of the bank window. Well, about the second blast blew out all the windows of the bank and cracked most of the windows in the C.W. Spencer Hardware, and cracked practically all of the windows on the east side of the business district of Wayland. Now, that's how stout the blasts were.
And where was the Spencer Hardware?
The Spencer Hardware was directly north of the bank.
Okay.
And it just jarred those windows out. The fellas firing there were making it pretty hot and heavy for the fellas on the inside of the bank, the bandits, setting off the charges. And it kept getting a little farther in between charges each time. And I think I mentioned the fact that that the first charge was somewhere around 1:30. It continued that way with the vigilantes firing in there, and there was I suppose as many as 250 rounds of ammunition fired between the bandits and the...
They were firing back at them?
Oh yes, definitely. There was at least five of the bandits firing back at them. Mm-hmm. And there's still scars, many scars, on the side of the old hotel and bank building where Frank Gardner, who's shooting a 30 caliber Springfield rifle, he hit many, many places, and they're still visible today in the brick walls where they knocked out big chunks out of the bricks.
Mm-hmm.
And
where was the hotel? Where was
the hotel was 10 feet, approximately 10 feet south of the bank building.
Okay.
There was, of course, comical things in those happenings. There was an elderly gentleman, a very precise gentleman by the name of Jimmy Robinson, who owned the telephone company, whose switch office was directly above the bank. And when they questioned him as to what he did, because he slept in the hotel just almost directly to the above where the bank was being robbed, not quite. And he, being a very precise old gentleman, he said that he arose immediately and made way to the rear of the hall. At that time, Ruth Morgan, who is a retired school teacher now and lives here in Crawfordsville, was the telephone operator, and there was a one of the bandits came up and just pointed a gun at her and told her to remain quiet and not to call any alarms out or try to call any alarms out. And in the meantime, they had shot the streetlights all out. They stood in one place. In fact, I was very impressed over one of the robbers' marksmanship, because he stood in one place and shot all the streetlights out there in the cross street on Wayland. Hmm. And he didn't spend too long shooting them out. I think maybe he missed two or three times, but most of the time a light went out when he shot.
Mm-hmm.
And it continued on till a point.
What about that light that you said was shining down?
That remained on, because that was backed by C.W. Spencer's lumber yard on the next street west.
Mm-hmm.
That light remained on all the time and never was shot out.
Mm-hmm.
The robbers stayed in the bank approximately till 3 o'clock in the morning. In other words, they were there about 2 hours. In the meantime, Mr. Worrell, W-O-R-R-E-L, I can't remember his first name.
Mm-hmm.
He was the telephone at that time of the Wayland telephone system, he managed to slip out of his home and go down a back alley and climb a telephone pole at the south edge of town. And with a field telephone or a repair telephone, he managed to get the word out that the town of Wayland was under siege by robbers. This, he got out about, to my knowledge, about 2 o'clock in the morning. And of course the sheriff was called, and other law enforcement agencies were called at different places and alerted. Well, it has always been pretty much of a joke due to the fact that the sheriff had a flat tire on the way to Wayland and didn't arrive until about 3:15. Probably a very good thing for everyone concerned.
Who was the sheriff in those?
I cannot quote who the sheriff was at that time, but it's always been quite a joke at that time that he supposedly had a flat tire. Now, at that time, the Vigilantes was also formed in the town of Russellville, of course, just about 4.5 miles south of there, and the explosions were so loud that I think it was 4 of the fellows in Russellville heard this, and Bert Murray, who was game warden at that time, he picked up 2 other men, and I can't remember their names, and they started towards Wayland. They were well armed and was coming over to give assistance. Well, they passed, apparently, the robbers as they headed south and east out of Wayland, but they were unaware that they were passing them.
Mm-hmm.
And then, about the time they arrived in Wayland, they realized that they had passed them, and they gave chase to them, and apparently did see them go through Brownsville, and at that time they lost them, and that, as far as I know, was as far as any identification with the robbers. They were never caught, they were never identified, or anything was ever brought up and proved about it. Now, they did not get any money. However, they were close enough that when the bank agents came, they took just a carpenter's crowbar and proceeded to pry the bank open. That was how close they did finally get to get through the money.
Yeah, what kind of a, was it one of those big old safes like they used to have in the banks?
It was a built-in safe.
It was
a built-in vault-type safe with 2 doors.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very interesting story of this Mr. Whirl, the telephone manager. While he was up this pole spreading the alarm, he had a big police dog, I remember, and this police dog was laying at the bottom of the pole, and for some reason, one of the bank bandits came back to their automobile, which was parked on the south side of town, and he went directly under the pole, and the dog got after him and chased him away, but he never did think to look up to see Whirl up the pole.
Did nobody got hurt though, huh?
Yes, apparently we who were witnesses did think that one of the bandits was hit with a shotgun blast that George Slavin's fired.
Oh.
There was a little blood in the bank.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of profane language come out of there one time when there was quite a bit of firing done.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Worrell, who saw the bandits leave, and of course the three vigilantes and myself and two or three others, thought that they were assisting one of the fellows when they left.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no definite proof that any of them was hit.
How many of them were there?
To the best of our combined knowledge, when we tried to, as all the people that were witnesses, we decided that there was 8 or 9
mm-hmm.
involved.
And what kind of a vehicle were they in?
They were in...
Well, I had more than one vehicle.
No. Apparently, they only had one vehicle, according to Mr. Worrell and according to Bert Murray, the game warden that saw them, that passed them. They were all apparently in a big car of some kind. I don't think it ever was identified as to what kind of a car it was.
Now, was that a, was the car going going east from
going east from Waveland on the Russellville Waveland Road? Then they kept back through Russellville. In other words, when they hit the Russellville Browns Valley Road, they cut back to the left and came back and went through Browns Valley. In other words, they were observed.
They would have gone east on the, what we call now, the Turkey Run Road.
No, you're mistaken.
Well, how would they go?
There is a blacktop road that goes out to Russellville, out the south end of Waveland,
yeah.
And then turns east,
yeah.
and goes east about 3 miles, and then turns back to the right to go into Russellville.
Oh.
To go to the left, you go through Browns Valley on that same road. That's the way the robbers took out of there.
Yeah. And then they went up to Browns Valley.
That's right. They went through Browns Valley because, well, Mr. Manfred Pitts at that time was one of the witnesses of them going through Browns Valley.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, was it ever suspected? Did anybody ever surmise who could have been, who could that gang could have been?
To my knowledge, they never was any suspects apprehended. There was, as I remember right, the Lewiston Bank was held up in probably the same way. I'm not sure, but I think the Coatesville Bank was robbed about the same way. And one or two others I remember.
Did they leave any tools behind or any of their equipment?
None other than just some TNT blasting powder or whatever it was. And as I remember right, that was about the only thing.
How on earth did they ever get out of there without getting killed to get out of the situation they were in?
Well, you must remember that there was a back door to the bank.
Oh, nobody was back there.
And nobody was back there. No one was back there at the back door. And they went out the back door, then down an alley, which was not lighted.
Okay.
And really, just more or less slipped out. Nobody knew they were actually when they left. In fact, a very interesting fact, Miss Mae Spencer was the first one that got nerve enough to get up and really actually look in the bank window.
I'll be there. Miss Mae Spencer is still here.
Right, the Mae Spencer that is still here.
And that was, you think it was about 3 a.m. at that end?
That was about 3 a.m. is when they left.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they were in town about 2 hours.
Uh-huh.
And
must have made an awful flash when those glass go off, huh?
Yes, it did. Our house shook pretty freely. There were some pretty big explosions.
Yeah. Now, Norm, anything else you think of about that bank? Well, that's a pretty complete story, huh? I ought to go on to some other things, but anything more about the bank robbery that you remember? That's it. Now, your dad is Gary Gilman. Yeah?
That's right.
And he was not a member of the Vigilantes.
No.
Were there only three members in Waveland?
There was only three members of the Vigilantes in Waveland.
Uh-huh.
And
they weren't very good shots, it seems to me, if all those rounds were fired.
Well, they were not in exactly position where they could shoot directly into the bank. They were situated at more or less of an angle where the robbers were protected by a brick wall, pretty well. Mm-hmm. That although I think even today the corner of the old OK Galloway garage still shows the accuracy of the bank bandit shooting. Mm-hmm. Because that particular corner is chipped off about 7 feet high all the way down where those fellows shot at the boys that was shooting around that corner.
Now, at that time, the bank, was it privately owned, or who owned the bank?
The bank at that time was not a privately owned bank completely.
Was there more than one bank in Waveland?
No, there never was. Mr. Charles Johnson was the manager at that time, and it was a stock bank.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about the telephone company? You owned that?
The telephone company was owned by Mr. James Robinson, and it was a private telephone company at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I might say that Ruth Morgan, who was the girl that was held by the bandits, who was the night telephone operator, later turned out to be the same girl that was held in Michigan City.
What was that? Let's go. That is, you mean the same Ruth Joyner?
Yes.
The one who was on This Is Your Life?
Right, that is right.
And she was the...
She was the night telephone operator and went through a terrifying experience there. So she's had her share of terrifying experiences.
Now, when that happened, did the bandits stay up there in the office and keep a gun on her? What happened?
Until he was sure that all the telephone wires were cut out of Waveland.
Yeah.
Rearranged.
Now that's the first that I ever knew that Ruth Joyner was involved in that thing too.
Yes. Very good.
Uh-huh. And but she was, it was only till they got the wires cut and then
which I'm not sure about the time, was probably only, I would guess, maybe 15 or 20 minutes or a half an hour.
Mm-hmm.
But all the wires were cut. They were successful in completely cutting all the wires that led out of Waveland.
Mm-hmm. So the telephone system then was a private company and probably only had a operator. Was the operator on at night? I'm surprised at that.
Yes. So all the time during that period when there was an operator that slept in the telephone office in case of fire or anything, she actually would ring the alarm, which was an old fire bell right there by her office.
Well, I'll be darned. Well, you know, my I'm gonna be interested in that, because my wife knows Ruth Joyner, and I've known her when she worked in the oil fire department.
Yes, right.
Okay, let's, I think that's about all on this side of the tape, but, let's turn that tape over. I'll just run that to the end and then turn it over. About some of the other things that, you know about Wavell, maybe you've done a little thinking about it, and you can tell me a little bit about.
Okay.
Have there been any other exciting events like that in Wavell in your lifetime?
Well, of course, we went through one of the big fires there, which, well, actually, we had two big fires in Wavell.
What were they?
Well, when the, they both involved my grandfather, as far as that goes. That was when, the...
Who was your grandfather?
George T. Dillman.
George Dillman.
There was one